Welcome back everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Adirola. It is Wednesday, which is also day 26 of the shutdown. JR, welcome to day 26 of the shutdown.
Welcome to day 26. So to feel the pain for a lot of people that are dealing with day 26, it's you have to stop and think about it. I remember I thought about it yesterday. Like as you drive to work, as you go home, as you pick your kid up from
it's
school.
It's still happening.
Just think about how much different your life would be. And that sucks.
Yeah.
Straight up. I mean, we don't think about that enough.
Yeah.
So remember that. As you go to your job, a lot of people can't. And then what they have to try and do to make bills.
Or have to go and aren't getting paid.
Yeah.
And also ongoing, we're in day 3 of the LA teacher strike. So we're still awaiting any sort of sign that the teachers are going to get what they want. That's going to be very interesting to watch. There's a million things that we want to get to. It's a gigantic news day. So big that I don't want to wait. So we're just going to jump right into it. As of this morning, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced that she has communicated with the president about the upcoming State of the Union and said that, you know, while this shutdown is going on, it doesn't really make sense to do a State of the Union. You know, like security, can we really be sure that's going to be safe? So many people aren't going to be around. Maybe we just hold off on the whole shutdown thing. And the way she worded it in the letter to him was, I suggest that we work together to find another time. But then others in the House are saying, yeah, it's off now. So that's an exciting development. I hadn't thought about that.
This was a thought. I mean, I didn't consider, I mean, considering the Speaker of the House has the control to uninvite the president to the State of the Union address that he delivers. Because, of course, you know who sits behind the president when they're delivering is Nancy Pelosi and the vice president.
Yeah. Yeah, and another interesting wrinkle to this that
it's like they're hosting the event. It's what I'm sorry.
They do, yeah.
She's hosting, she's one of the hosts. She comes
exactly.
in and she wants to give you your coffee before you come in.
Yeah, and I've been so focused on the shutdown and all the stuff going on around it that I hadn't really thought much about the State of the Union. But like if he got to do the State of the Union, he would of course use it to attack the Democrats over the shutdown. And apparently that is something they'd been working on. So Lauren Fox tweeted, my colleague Caitlin Collins adds some context. Stephen Miller and other White House speechwriters have been working on the State of the Union address for weeks. An administration official said they were prepared to craft it around the government shutdown targeting Democrats if it was still closed. If it was still closed, they can control whether it will still be closed. And so they would extend it, they would get to there, and then they would use it with a gigantic audience to attack the Democrats. Why would the Democrats go along with that? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and then so it also gives them, as you alluded to, an incentive to continue to do so. So, and we also know the way that this president works, this entire administration works, is they're looking to promote themselves at the expense of the American people. Mm-hmm. Now, I also wonder to what degree that Nancy Pelosi uninviting the president to the State of the Union is effective. What can that really be done?
Well, I don't know how effective it would be in any other case. In this case, dude loves an audience. He definitely wants to have that speech. I mean, they just had the address because they couldn't wait until the State of the Union.
She's the authority last word figure on this? That's what I
that,
to
oh, in terms of whether, yeah, I think that they could stop it if they want to. We'll see. Also, I want to give them credit while we're talking about this, that they have not caved like a bunch of weenies yet on the shutdown. That's good. It could happen while we're live on air. I don't know. But so far, they haven't. I would have suspected we wouldn't get to day 26.
Yeah.
That they would have already caved. They haven't done that, so that is good. Moving on, other good news. Some of the committee assignments for the new House Democrats have been announced, and we have a couple of good ones to talk about. And that is for the House Financial Services Committee. A couple of big names joining it, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who tweeted, financial services is one of just 4 exclusive committees in the House. It oversees big banks, lending, and the financial sector. I am very grateful for the opportunity to sit on this committee as a freshman and look forward to working under the leadership of Representative Maxine Waters. Personally, I'm looking forward to digging into the student loan crisis, examining for-profit prisons, ICE detention, and exploring the development of public and postal banking to start. Smiley face. So yeah, that is going to be great. I mean, not only her being there, this is one of the most powerful House committees, but also Maxine Waters being in charge of it. Like, in terms of their willingness to do things that you know the Republicans are not going to like, that seems like a pretty strong combo there.
It's good, and I'm looking forward to see what kind of influence she can have on that as well. She's rubbing a lot of people the wrong way, even in her own party, and also, of course, like conservatives and Republicans. So I think the approach, we'll see what the approach is, and we can assume pretty much the best.
Yeah, we'll see. As well as AOC, you also have Rashida Tlaib joining the same committee, and Ayanna Pressley, who tweeted, to anyone that's ever come home to an eviction notice, felt overwhelmed by student debt, or worked the second and third shift, when I learned that I was appointed to the Financial Services Committee, tonight I thought of you. We belong everywhere. I'll never stop fighting for you. So those are all those awesome. Are some great changes. You know, I would have liked to have seen AOC or others in this group on the Ways and Means Committee, which is, you know, really significant as well in terms of setting the budget, taxation, stuff like that. Hopefully that will happen at some point, but this is not a nothing committee, right. And so that is certainly a good change. But why don't we turn to the big political news of the morning? More people are running for the presidency. I say more because I'm going to announce one that has announced, but somebody could be announcing right now. Kirsten Gillibrand, senator, has announced as of last night on Stephen Colbert that she has formed an exploratory committee. Now, they always say that, even though they know they're probably going to run. But she was clear even on Stephen Colbert, I did it because I am going to run. Not as like a, hey, everybody, what do you think about me running? So Kirsten Gillibrand is another. I mean, we are 2 weeks into January, and there's Tulsi Gabbard, Kirsten Gillibrand, Richard Ojeda, Julian Castro. I mean, others like Elizabeth Warren, you know, is
Elizabeth Warren.
That's fairly, like some are more explicit about it than others. But we already have a bigger group than there was last time around, and we haven't reached really the second half of January.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what the number is going to stretch to. I think 20 was what people were considering at one point we were going to get to.
So we're looking at multiple debates per night, because they're not going to put 20 people on one thing.
If you compare it to when the Republicans were running and they had their primary season and they had 16, I believe, already.
And they had two separate debates.
Right. Yeah, they had like the B team debate that happened at while your children are still in school, and then they had the evening debate. So yeah. It's kind of, I mean, who you have to rank this, and it's gonna maybe be some good voices as we're gonna dive into with Gillibrand, the voices and the varying approaches and agendas that they'll have, but also some of the similarities. It's gonna be a tough thing to actually look through.
Yeah, but because of this, and because we probably will do those A and B debates, this is a breaking news for hosts and people who work at TYT. Don't expect a lot of early nights in like 2 months from now. Those are going to be some long nights. There's going to be a lot of them. But on Gillibrand, we're going to be breaking down, you know, her positions, legislation she's passed in the past or put forward. We're going to have a guest coming on in the near future to do that. Right now, I do want to focus on one of the issues, which everybody who runs is going to face a number of issues. First of which is, how do you differentiate yourself from literally one to two dozen other people? That is going to be difficult. Now, she's a senator, but there's also a lot of other senators who are going to be running. And here is one of the things that's going to come up for her that I think is going to be a little bit difficult, and that is her political past. Same sort of thing that Hillary Clinton had to deal with. And even on certain issues that people had with Bernie Sanders in terms of his, you know, voting for one or two, I would say relatively minor gun rights sorts of things, that did come up because we want to see consistency. Well, that's an issue for Gillibrand. So according to 538, her political career began in 2007 in the House. Gillibrand's political positions at the time were much more conservative, and she was among the least liberal members of the Democratic caucus in the House, ranking 209th out of 241 between 2007 and 2009. During that time, she held an A rating from the NRA and was against protections for sanctuary cities. Eventually, she ascended to Hillary Clinton's seat and angered many on the left. Then she switched it up, embracing a range of liberal positions, seeing her NRA rating downgraded to an F. As of December 2017, she was the seventh most liberal member of the 46-person Democratic caucus. I checked one ideological rating that had her as the second most left after Bernie Sanders. Which is good, certainly. I mean, I care more about your positions now than about your positions then. But then wasn't decades ago. It wasn't 30 years ago. And getting an A rating for the NRA, that takes work. I mean, I think people will legitimately have significant issues with that. Now, she's great on a number of issues, and even then was great on some of these issues. And now, you know, she's rejected corporate PAC money and stuff like that. That's good. I think that there is cause for alarm, though, especially when there are other candidates who share many of your pros without sharing the cons.
So, This is where it's hard when it gets to a field that's going to be this crowded, is you're going to get a lot of this, as I mentioned, a lot of people that have similar agendas, but then have different backgrounds. And honestly, I predict what I'm going to end up doing throughout this process, and as we vet each one of these candidates, it's going to sound like I'm in support of damn near all of them. Mm-hmm. So if, 12 years ago, you had a certain rating with the NRA, which was negative, or you had a certain level of conservatism as a Democrat in the House, cool. As things have changed, I think that's the whole point of representation. As you see where your constituents stand and where they're, what things they care about, if you change your views because you represent your constituents, I think that's perfect. So in the past, you know who was also way less open on LGBTQ rights? The society in general. Mm-hmm. So in thinking, I'm representative of people, I'm going to be this way on civil rights for certain folks, it's bad. And there was plenty of people who were right, and they were in the minority of it, and it's cool. But if your constituency changes and you see how things move, if you move with it, I think that gives us a sign that if you end up getting into the White House, you're not going to be the stubborn person who makes all these promises and they end up being empty, mm-hmm. and you just continue to go with what you previously were. So what indication do we have that she's 2007 Gillibrand versus 2019 Gillibrand?
I get what you're saying, and I agree. Simply maintaining the same position despite changing circumstances would be mm-hmm. ridiculous. We don't want that. My concern is there's moving on like a particular issue, like Barack Obama mm-hmm. on gay marriage, for instance, or even Hillary Clinton on the same thing.
Yeah.
Then there's a generalized thing where you were one of the most conservative Democrats to one of the most liberal or progressive Democrats. A generalized change like that over a decade, I wish everybody did that hypothetically, but in particular cases, it can make us suspicious. And I think the most likely explanation is she is trying to match her constituents.
Right.
But that isn't the only explanation about why she's changed on those things. It's a good one. Yeah. It's probably a large part of it. But it makes me concerned that were she to get into the White House, could she potentially change her positions for reasons other than simply representation? And I want senators to move in this way. And I'm not saying you're a bad person if you move. You're a good person. You should evolve. But should we pluck you from a group of 20 to 25 people and say, you are our champion, you are our avatar, you go out there right. and fight for us?
Now, wherever she lands in that group of 20 or so, it's up to voters, obviously. But I don't think, I guess we're at the stage of writing people off or not. And I'm not ready to write her off because of 12 years ago.
Okay.
And I also am not saying, hey, I can't wait till she gets to the general election, I'm gonna vote for her, you know? Mm-hmm. So we have to see where everyone is.
I agree, and we're gonna have to see what happens with the debates, what legislation people put forward. I am not one of those people that tries to say, hey, don't think about this person because of this right. one fact I'm gonna tell you. You don't have to ever consider them anymore. Right. That is cheap and stupid, I don't do that. So even this, you'll keep an open mind, but there's gonna be a lot of people out there.
True.
There's a lot of people we can support, a lot of people we can't support. Look, could I press a button and she could replace Trump? Press a button.
Absolutely.
But that's not the decision that we necessarily have to make.
Right.
So there will be more on that, obviously, in the future. We do have to take our first break, but don't go anywhere. Much more for you after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Last week in North Carolina, two women were released on a bond after being arrested over kidnapping and sexual battery of a transgender individual in a bathroom. And perhaps not shockingly in America, it did not make much news nationally. Here to talk about why that might be, to break it down and some of the context around that issue, is Tony Zasharafatin, director of Trans in Trumpland. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me, John.
Very glad to have you here. So you're familiar with this attack. Tell us a little bit about what happened and what it represents.
Sure. So essentially what happened was, it is in a conservative state in North Carolina where they tried to pass a anti-trans bathroom law, which essentially would mean that someone can only use a bathroom based on their birth sex. So for example, if you're born as female, but you're a trans man like me, so I'm a guy, I would only be able to use a women's bathroom. Unfortunately, that law did not pass in North Carolina. There was a lot of outrage about that. But even though a law might not pass, that doesn't mean that the culture or like the hatred doesn't persist. So I think what we saw what happened in North Carolina was two women who weren't trans, they essentially assaulted and also revealed their genitalia and abused a trans woman at a bar who was in the appropriate bathroom. She was a trans woman. She was using the women's bathroom. So I think what we're seeing is really this kind of residual hatred and this continued prejudice against trans people, and especially in conservative states such as North Carolina. So on an everyday level, this is really revealing what trans people go through when we're just trying to use bathrooms and public facilities just like everybody else. And, you know, I'm very happy that nothing ultimately happened to the trans woman in terms of her losing her life, but we have seen a rise in the amount of violence as well and murders against trans people, where in other states there have been trans people who lost their life during recent attacks similar to this.
So I want to return to the sort of media silence about this for the most part. I mean, thankfully, as you point out, she wasn't killed, but she was groped and, you know, like held in the bathroom, sexually assaulted. And what's amazing to me is that it's in a state with the past that you described. It's happening in a literal bathroom. And the right's argument about this has always been that they are terrified about what could happen if they were ever in the same bathroom as a member of the transgender community. And here you have an attack in a bathroom against a member of that community. And not only are they silent on it, I get that. But even people who are allies and, you know, in favor of transgender rights, largely it's like, I guess there's just people seem bored by covering this sort of violence, this sort of attack, which is obviously, as we know, part of an ever increasing problem in this country. Do you find the silence to be disconcerting,
right,
that there aren't people who are more vocal in defending this community, especially in instances of assaults like this?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right about the fact that there's been a lot of media silence, especially about this recent attack in North Carolina in the bathroom. And I think, honestly, it is a little bit bothersome because it is a growing problem. And it's been a problem for a while, but we really are seeing a significant rise since Trump took office. And, you know, I think the allyship really does need to come forward, whether it's from fellow LGBT people and even people who aren't LGBT, because this isn't just an issue that affects trans people, but say, for example, a person who isn't trans, but say, for example, like a woman who's masculine might be more of a tomboy, but for all respect and purposes is like a heterosexual straight woman. What if she goes into a woman's bathroom and gets perceived as a man or gets perceived as someone that doesn't quote unquote belong in that bathroom? Then you're at threat of violence as well.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the silence has been concerning because hate affects everybody, you know, no matter how you identify in the political spectrum. And, you know, why should we be attacked for what we're perceived to be as our gender when we're just trying to pee, you know, pee and use the bathroom?
So I also wanted to ask you about your upcoming film, Trans in Trump Land. So obviously it's not out yet. We're gonna have to wait to see it to get the whole picture of what's been going on. But so far, as you're getting towards that, Donald Trump as president, you know, he held a great deal of power over the past couple of years. What effect has that had on the community over the past 2+ years?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I'll give you the statistics, which are really just, you know, it's a hard truth, whether, you know, Trump supporters want to believe it or not. But there's 2017 was, as you mentioned, the deadliest year on record for both violence and actual murders against trans people, especially trans women of color. So that's a hard statistic there. We also, Trump has delayed the passage of federal guarantees to healthcare coverage. So we would have been on that path because, as you might know, each state doesn't have the same laws. So for example, me in New York, I have healthcare coverage. I have laws that protect me as a trans person. Someone in North Carolina doesn't have access to healthcare. There is no guarantee that insurance companies will pay. They also might not have the same right to use a bathroom as I do in New York. So Trump has delayed the federal passage of those bills. He's also tried to eradicate us as a protected category in civil rights laws. And so we really have like regressed in that regard. So I would say even on a personal level, I, you know, posting this on Instagram, comparing my transition from before being female and now, and I get transphobic comments that are incredibly hurtful. And I never thought those before at all. Instagram since 2011. You know, on a personal level, on a policy level, I'm seeing the everyday effects that his hatred's having for sure. And it's not just me. Yeah.
So very sad to hear, and obviously a complex topic. Certainly, we'll be looking forward to your upcoming film about this. And so, Tony, I just want to thank you for joining us and helping break down the situation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, much more news to get to. Welcome back. Much more to get to. I did want to briefly mention, I forgot to mention it in the last segment, but the movie that we were talking about, Trans in Trumpland, which is not out yet, I believe this month, actually, the Kickstarter for that is going to launch. Don't quite quote me on that, but if you are interested in supporting that project, then keep an eye on Kickstarter and you might get a chance to do that. But with that, let's move into other news. Donald Trump is a racist. We know that. We're not particularly shocked by it. There rarely are any consequences for it. I mean, hell, he became president potentially because of that more than any other individual factor. But today we do have a little bit of pushback against some of his more explicit racism. And this comes from his recent attacks on Twitter against Elizabeth Warren. So she did her live Instagram video. She had the gall to do that and he was incensed by it. And so he tweeted this. If Elizabeth Warren, often referred to me by me as Pocahontas, did this commercial from Bighorn or Wounded Knee instead of her kitchen, with her husband dressed in full Indian garb, it would have been a smash. That tweet brought to you by the President of the United States. He went on to say, this is less offensive but more stupid. Best line in the Elizabeth Warren beer catastrophe is to her husband, quote, thank you for being here, I'm glad you're here. It's their house, he's supposed to be there. She means the video, ding dong. She's not talking about the house. We know they live together. You don't live with your wife potentially, but we know they live together. We're pretty clear on that.
The worst part about these tweets, I'm sorry before you go on, is you can always write off, you can't, but you would normally write off and go, yeah, maybe he's drinking. Oh man, look at these drunk tweets.
He doesn't drink. He's just naturally punch drunk. Usually, actually.
Usually drunkards can blame their stupidity on being drunk.
Yeah, not with him. I wish he was a drunk. That would make me feel a little bit better, actually. So look, a lot of people have an issue with that. His just casual racism using the names of historic Native Americans, not only the names, but also now the events as well. And members of various Native American organizations have now pushed back against this. The first quote I want to read for you is by Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians. It says, we condemn in the strongest possible terms the casual and callous use of these events as part of a political attack. Hundreds of Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho people lost their lives at the hands of the invading US Army during these events, and their memory should not be desecrated as a rhetorical punchline. It goes on to say, flippant references to deadly historical conflicts and name-calling that mocks Native identity have no place in our political discourse. I urge the president to focus instead on doing the people's business, including ending the needless government shutdown that is harming so many Native people. We'll have more for you in a little bit. But what's interesting about this interaction between him and Elizabeth Warren is many people are concerned that were she to be the Democratic nominee, that her past thing with the DNA test is going to be a big issue for her. But also, he's just going to keep attacking her, and that's going to help him more than it helps her. I wonder, though, if that's necessarily the case. If another round of obvious, explicit, constant, gleeful racism would actually help him outside of his hardcore base.
I've heard it over and over again. Ever since ever since Elizabeth Warren announced that she's going to run, they said one of the first couple knocks against her, actually the first, is remember that DNA test?
Yeah.
Remember her fight with Donald Trump? That's going to energize him and his base. And continuing on, you know, that debacle of the DNA test that she took, it's going to hurt her chances for the presidency. running against a guy who is the president. Mm-hmm. And you know what they did mention? That rabid, continuous racism that continues to get spewed from the White House, from the actual president that's already in office, mm-hmm. Using slurs to reference Native Americans for this candidate, and then continuing on Twitter with these juvenile racist jokes. Yeah. And then how Native Americans had to come out and denounce what he said. Is anybody gonna then go, hey, remember how the president continued to spew racist nonsense from his yeah. Twitter account and in speeches and in front of Native Americans and referencing massacres that happened in our history that we apologized for? Are we going to reference any of that? No, it's Elizabeth Warren's fault, and she's going to fall short of it. Now, if you're bringing that up, you're also part of the problem because you think, hey, if you go on this racist tirades against Native Americans in our country, it doesn't mean anything. The problem is the woman who took the DNA test, not the president who's demeaning a large yeah. group of people that were massacred. That means you're okay with it too.
Yeah, and then went on to say after she took it, it doesn't count. It only counts if I administer it. So he says he wants to draw blood from a female politician. So you always have with the racism a hearty helping of weird misogyny that is his go-to, perhaps even more than racism. I mean, we saw that in the last election. It didn't seem to dissuade many Republicans from voting for him. But we also know how the 2018 election went, and so it's possible that as the years go by, more and more women might be turned off by a little bit of that constant weird misogyny coming from him. I do want to read one or two more of these quotes, though. The chairman of the Rosebud Sioux tribe, Rodney Bordeaux, called the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre in South Dakota, quote, one of the darkest and most tragic chapters in the history of the Sioux Nation, in which as many as 400 unarmed Native Americans, many of them women and children, were slaughtered by US soldiers. Bordeaux called Trump's tweet, quote, racist and disrespectful, and demanded the president apologize for his, quote, shameful and ignorant misstatement. And again, the thing is, I don't think Trump knows anything about those historical events.
At all.
Which should worry us enough that he's just so ignorant of it when he's literally the president of the United States. But to then use these things that he knows nothing about and has no genuine curiosity for, simply to slander and attack a female politician, like how little do you have to care for this community? That you can just take the entirety of their historical experience and their current identity and just say, that is a punchline for me and I will use it as such.
If you attack a politician because you don't like them and start calling them Kunta Kinte, mm-hmm. and say, hey, how about those hundreds of years of slavery we went through in this country? How you think you're so big? And then start talking about the massacre, selling, and dismantling of families mm-hmm. and an entire race of people. And you think it's as a joke. And then after saying that, thinking that's going to be a positive for you in your campaign or in your opposition to her, why do we accept that?
Yeah.
Because we don't. I'm telling you, it's because we add to this as well as the society and continue to go, well, those are just Native Americans. Mm. Because we've reached a point where, you know, the Holocaust, you can't joke about that. Slavery, they still do, but you really can't joke about that. 9/11, you can't joke about that. So if he does all that, he's going to catch some hell for it. Mm. For some reason, this is totally in bounds and it's okay. And it's going to energize him. No, they openly said this might help him out. This is going to hurt her against him. Racism, blatant and open racism, is gonna help him and hurt her?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't remember, there was a comedian who talked about how the Native American community is so ignored nationally and politically that you can just attack them and it doesn't matter. There's no consequences or whatever. I don't know, was it Dave Chappelle? It might have been Dave Chappelle, I forget. And that is the case. Now, hopefully things are changing because while there's been like no political representation government for that community for literally hundreds of years in this country, as of 2018, there are several representatives of the community. I hope that that will cause some of these people who so casually express both ignorance and malice against this community will be a little bit more hesitant to do that in the future.
And every time he steps in front of one of these reporter gaggles or is about to take off to go to North Carolina, wherever he's going to fly off to say something stupid, every reporter should ask him, hey, do you take back the racist statements you said about Wounded Knee and the massacre and all these things you want to talk about? Do you take them back? And he says, blows it off. The next person should ask him again. Yeah. This should follow him around.
Yes, it won't, but it should. With that, we are going to take another break. When we come back, Varshini Prakash, founder of the Sunrise Movement, is going to be joining us once again on the Damage Report to break down where they go from here in pushing for a Green New Deal. Finally, people know what the Green New Deal is. And you know what? they kind of like it. It's polling quite well, and that is thanks to the efforts of a handful of politicians and also the Sunrise Movement. The question now is, where do we go from here? And joining us to help lay out that path is Varshini Prakash, founder of the Sunrise Movement. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, nice to be here.
We're very glad to have you here, always. Look, there's been about 2 months now of conversation about the Green New Deal. More and more politicians are stating that they are supportive of it, and the polls certainly look good. What is the strategy inside of the movement going forward the next few months? How do you continue that momentum and make it turn from something people support in rhetoric to actual policy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we spent the last 3 months really shaking up DC. We've completely changed what the litmus test for Democrats on the issue of climate change looks like. It's not some lowest common denominator question of, do you believe in the validity of the climate science? It is, you know, will you actually stand up and have the courage to say no to fossil fuel money and back something like a Green New Deal that's actually going to help avert catastrophe? So I've been blown away by the energy and enthusiasm by thousands of young people across the nation in every corner of the country who have been so excited and feeling empowered that there is a movement that they can be a part of and politicians who are accountable to them. So the next step, you've seen, you know, when the House rules came out a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately, Pelosi and Democratic leadership failed to include any of our demands in the Select Committee for the Climate Crisis that was created. No subpoena power, fossil fuel funded politicians can sit on the committee, and there's not a mandate to draft a plan for a Green New Deal. So essentially, this is like if your doctor told you that you had stage 3 cancer and then proceeded to prescribe you multivitamins. It's utterly insufficient for this time. So what we're doing is we're taking the Green New Deal beyond the Beltway and actually bringing it to the American people. The polling that you talked about, 80% of Americans, that includes 64% of Republicans and 92% of Democrats support a Green New Deal. But also 80% of this country doesn't actually know what a Green New Deal is. So when they know what a Green New Deal is, they support it in super majorities. So for the from March through May, we are launching the Road to a Green New Deal. It's going to be a 15-city tour that includes some of the most inspiring all-stars of the Democratic freshmen, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and more. It's going to go through climate-ravaged states that are also key political battlegrounds, places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Virginia, and more. And we are going to bring the Green New Deal to tens of thousands of young people and provide them with the tools and resources to actually pressure their federal policymakers to back a Green New Deal.
Well, that certainly sounds good. I mean, look at what you've been able to accomplish even before rising to national significance in terms of your group. Having a lot of extra people is certainly going to help. As you're doing this, we are going to be launching into the Democratic primary because elections are now constant in America. We're already in it, basically. Let's not kid ourselves. So I want to ask you to make sort of a prediction. Will supporting a Green New Deal be necessary to succeed as running in this Democratic primary in 2020?
Oh, absolutely. And we're already seeing it out the gate be one of the defining features of whether a politician, a candidate for president, is actually serious about tackling the climate crisis or not. We've already seen half a dozen presidential contenders come out saying that they will back a Green New Deal, some even pledging no fossil fuel money. Obviously, the devil's in the details, and seeing whether these politicians actually back 100% renewable by 2030, a job guarantee and a just transition for communities on the front lines of poverty and pollution is to be seen, but it's very positive. And a lot of what we're going to be doing over the next 2 years is ensuring that this stays at the top of the conversation and the debate for the presidential elections. Actually, we are going to be planning the largest popular demonstration at a presidential debate for one of the first debates of the summer. So really encourage anybody who wants to be a part of that and ensuring that a Green New Deal is central to the conversation for the Democratic Party, especially the presidency in 2019, 2020 and beyond, goes to sunrisemovement.org/GND to sign up there to attend the debate.
Well, that is certainly an exciting approach. I know that you have a hashtag change the debate focused around that. Hopefully I will be there as well. That's my personal hope at least. I want to ask you a little bit more of a difficult question in terms of being able to answer. But as you say, there's a number of politicians, including many who will run for president, that say that they back a Green New Deal. But I'm a bit of a skeptic, and I know that people define it differently. And when they say that they support it, I don't necessarily know exactly what they mean. So from your point of view, what does that statement have to include for it to be worth anything more than the, you know, air passing out of their lips to say it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are, you have reason to be afraid. We are also concerned about that, and we want to get out the gate really clearly defining what a Green New Deal stands for. And to us, to back a Green New Deal, you need to support a transition to a 100% renewable energy economy by 2030. You need to support a jobs guarantee to support any person who is who needs or wants a job doing the critical work of cleaning up our environment and averting climate catastrophe. And it needs to center racial and economic justice. It needs to ensure a just transition for workers and communities that are already experiencing the impacts of the climate crisis and will continue to experience those impacts because of the warming that's inevitable and can't be avoided. So that is some of the stuff that we are looking for in these politicians' platforms. We are not going to endorse until we see the full scale of what a economic and climate mobilization they're talking about might look like. And we think that having a robust debate about a Green New Deal and contestation over what it means is really going to push a race to the tops around climate ambition in this country.
So I think you sort of implied this in that answer, but will the movement actually be issuing an endorsement in the Democratic primary?
At some point, but we're not sure exactly when.
Oh, well, that is certainly exciting news. So I'm curious, sort of a follow-up to that, in terms of there's hypothetically shallow support for a Green New Deal and substantive, I would say actual support for a Green New Deal. I know that some have talked about it, some have talked about your organization as well. Are there politicians that have actually been in contact with the organization, talking about possibly working together, offering more than just a tweet or a statement in terms of actually supporting your organization's mission?
Definitely. A lot of the politicians that were in the original group of 45 members of Congress that supported Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Select Committee for a Green New Deal have actually stepped up and are clamoring to figure out what the next steps are in this moment and what they can do to support. So we've been hearing a lot from the co-chairs of the CPC, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan. Obviously, folks like Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Jonah Goose, other politicians, especially the freshman politicians who came out the gate supporting the Select Committee for a Green New Deal, are eager to figure out what the next steps are. And we're going to be talking about what to do politically and institutionally over the next few months with them.
Okay, well, that is certainly reassuring news. Varshini Prakash, founder of the Sunrise Movement, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, an absolutely juvenile attack against proposed raising of the top marginal tax rate coming from Scott Walker, immediately slapped down by people with more knowledge of how it actually works after this. So at long last, we have people actually making the case for potentially raising top tax rates back to where they historically were for literally decades during a time of unprecedented expansion in the US economy. And the response to that, the shock that we would ever go back to where we were a couple decades ago, has at times been a little bit childish. I would say the arguments used against it have been childish, but rarely have they been literally childish. And we have an example of that here. So Scott Walker, former Republican governor, here's what he had to say about this recent conversation. explaining tax rates before Reagan to fifth graders. Quote, imagine if you did chores for your grandma and she gave you $10. When you got home, your parents took $7 from you. The student said, that's not fair. Even fifth graders get it. Wink. There's no winky face, but he definitely winked when he tweeted it. The thing is, that's not necessarily accurate as to what the argument is for raising the top marginal tax rate, which I will just go to AOC because although he did not use her name, he's clearly talking about her.
Yeah.
She said, explaining marginal taxes to a far right former governor. I love that she put it in former. Yeah, imagine if you did chores for Abuela and she gave you $10. When you got home, you got to keep it because it's only $10. Then we tax the billionaire in town because he's making tons of money underpaying the townspeople. I love that. So good. Or as Jeff Smith says, imagine if you did chores for your dad and he paid you millions of dollars through a series of shell corporations in an illegal scheme to avoid taxes. I mean, the thing is, I think it was Dave Weigel who pointed out, Scott Walker would have a point if he was just more accurate. Imagine if you did chores for your grandma and she gave you $10 and you have already made $10 million that year. Then she took $7, perfectly accurate analogy.
You know what, also, if we're gonna go through all the analogies and saying fifth graders are gonna be mad about, so how about we say things like, hey, imagine you get paid this much amount of money and we're gonna take, we'll go up to still the $7 of your 10 and we start doing things with it that you didn't want done with and say it's in your name and say, hey, fifth graders, we're putting $7 of your $10 to wars that you hadn't wanted to have nothing to do with. They go, why are you using my money on stuff I don't want? Mm-hmm. And I actually want my money for me. That's what you guys are saying about entitlement and entitlement programs that actually help the people that pay for them. You say you don't deserve the money that you put out that comes back to you, but we're gonna take your money and use it for things that help us and people who didn't put into that same pot. I think they might have a problem with that too, but that's the basis for everything economics that the Republicans like to push with their tax cuts for rich folks and then taking money from other people and using it for things like wars and not using them for things like America. Yeah. In America. But, you know, we can make these explanations all the time for fifth graders and act like, you know, adults don't understand them. Just at least keep it consistent is what I would hope for.
Yeah, and I would point out, I mean, it's not just that Scott Walker, that it's a stupid explanation. It's a purposefully deceitful explanation. I mean, Scott Walker doesn't know a lot, but he knows the difference between the lowest tax rate and the highest tax rate and who it actually affects and what portion of your income it actually affects. He knows that. But he wants to lie. And why does he want to lie? So that his taxes won't be raised, so that his donors' taxes won't be raised. That is perfectly understandable, but still loathsome. I get why you, anybody who makes millions of dollars, for the most part, except for a few great individuals who still want taxes to be where they should be at, even though it would affect them, they're not gonna want their taxes to go up. We totally understand that. We should not be surprised by these sorts of attacks. But it is refreshing to finally have someone making the counter argument that AOC is not gonna back down because some former governor did a ridiculous cartoon version of her argument, that they actually respond, that they actually make the case, that is good. And by the way, there's a reason I think that this conversation is sticking and that more people are signing on to it. A poll published Tuesday shows broad support for the proposal from Ocasio-Cortez to hike the top income tax rate to 70%. The survey found 59% of voters backed the idea, including 45% of Republicans. Now that's just one poll and that's not literally what her proposal is. It was just her talking. We don't know what the actual proposal would be, but that shows that like people are frustrated because they know that they've been hoodwinked for decades. They know that all of this stuff of, hey, we'll cut your taxes and sure, it's only gonna affect the 1%, but someday it'll trickle down onto you. So don't worry. Like people have been checking for the trickle for decades now and they don't feel it. And so these arguments to maintain ever decreasing tax rates on the 1% corporations become less useful and less persuasive over time.
When are we gonna start asking them, you know, they want the good old days of way back when in America, when it was socially way more discriminatory and the system would actually tear down people that were in the minority group. They want those kinds of good old days, but they don't want the good old days of different tax rates because we don't bring those up. So every time they sit up and talk about this, just ask them again, why do you not like the good old days of old tax rates?
Yeah.
Why do you not like them? We don't confront them with the reality of what they're actually asking for.
Yeah. And now we do. A little bit, at least. Thank you.
We'll have Scott Walker on next week to answer these questions with John.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that. Imagine if you ever ran for president again. How sad of a run was that the last
time? What
is
he doing now? Well, who's Scott Walker work for
now? I'm assuming he's probably lobbying, but we will check and we'll find out for tomorrow. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but TDR has a Facebook page. It's The Damage Report TYT. If you haven't already started following that, please do so. It's a great place to find some of our videos as soon as they're posted, as well as some additional content that's gonna be coming out very soon. So feel free to do that. Facebook.com/The Damage Report TYT. And with that, thank you for joining us, Jarrow. It's good to have you here. Thank you for watching, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow morning with a lot more for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.